took a fair length of time, perhaps 3, 5 years, before they moved from the right-hand seat over to the left-hand seat. Mind you, they did all right in the long run. The chaps that went with the Venezuelan, they were expected to train a Venezuelan national within, I think it was a year or 2 years. And of course, once he was checked out to skipper level, that was the end of your job. He'd send you home. The ones that went with KLM had a different setup than the other airlines. They had no network permanent offices worldwide. And the commander of their airplanes to the Far East, Sumatra and out there, were ex-Navy ship captains. And they acted as captains, purser, everything. You see, they sold tickets right there, and he looked after all the passengers. He was the business agent, and he also told the crew when to go and when not to go. Of course, the captain of the aircraft also had overriding authority. If he thought it was unsafe, I guess he could tell the other fellow, but generally speaking, the ship captains were totally in charge. But KLM, the boys that went there, they found that 50% of their pay was all they could get out. The remainder was banked in guilders in Holland, and no way could they get it out while exchange controls were on. As I understand it, exchange controls were never lifted until...
Well, could you not buy merchandise there and take that out?
Well, I talked with some of the boys. A lot of them just left it there in the banks. They couldn't get it out. They were figuring they were going to go back and have a grand holiday in Holland someday, but they never could get it out. But as I say, these are some of the considerations that...
You had to deal with it, huh? Did you give much serious consideration to doing that?
To doing what?
To joining an airline as opposed to staying in the Air Force. Or was the Air Force your choice? Had you thought about getting out and doing something else?
Well, let's be realistic about this. We come out of the Depression into the Air Force. All we knew was flying, and to our sort of outlook, we're heading back into the Depression again. We're looking for jobs. The first one that was a permanent job, we're going to go. This was about the size of it. I haven't regretted it, no. But,
well, this is 1946. And
1946.
Okay, was there a policy that the Air Force had taken on as their post-war policy? Because I know the Army was in a state of flux at this time. They weren't sure what they were going to do and what the post-war Air Force was going to be like, or the Army was going to be like.
Well, we didn't know what the post-war Air Force was going to be like either. We had over a quarter of a million under arms in the Air Force, and we cut down to, at the low point, we were down to 12,000.
So who were the 12,000 chosen? Were they specialists in a particular role?
Yes, they made a sort of, out of 100 points, they were giving 20% for education, and a degree got 20%. If you had less than a degree, you were given, or a high school graduate, you were given 10 points, then plus 2 for each year's service. So that if you had 4 years in the service, you got 18 points, which was just under degree. And then there was 20% given for age factor. This, in retrospect, perhaps was a mistake because it creamed the youngest off all the rank levels, and we were all the same age, and we all progressed through the service at the same rate, and we were faced with an awful problem the end of the 60s because everybody were the retirement ages in the service are graduated too. You may recall, a flying officer is 45, flight attendants 47, squadron leaders 49, wing commanders 51, group captains 53, air common air rank 55. Well, having picked everybody in the youngest age bracket, mm-hmm. and then progressing along, like you were on a 45 degree curve. If mm-hmm. you were a flying officer, you were about 23 years of age. If you were a flight leader, you were probably 25. If you were a squadron leader, you were 26, 27. Wing commander, 28, 29. Well, you progress along like this, but then all of a sudden you hit this bank of retirement ages, which creamed you all off at once. And so you had a complete changeover in the service with going from a very experienced service to fairly...
I suppose what also would happen would be that, and did happen to you, was that promotion wasn't as fast as it could have been, or perhaps should have been.
This is true.
Because when you've got that
It wasn't. Mm. You had, in the main, the bulk of us, wartime, were slowed down because of this factor. But then, when I, a little later, then the 168, I went into 426 Squadron on North Stars, and the very first post-war intake, chaps that were high school graduates, maybe 1 year college, I was checking them out on North Stars. This same group were subject to very, very rapid promotion in order to take over. They were booming them up because they had sort of 5 years younger, 8 years younger.
And they're going above you guys.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They boomed up to group captain, air rank, right fast.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first, second, third post-war intakes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's diverging a little bit. As I say, 20% was given for age. Then 20% was given for your specialty. And we needed pilots, you got 20%. If, however, you were Tail End Charlie, no matter how qualified, we didn't see any place for you in the post-war Air Force, so you got a big zero for that.
Mm-hmm.
20% was given for your personal assessments, and this was your R211's assessment form made out every 6 months during the time you were in, and it depended on your sort of officer character, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And 20% was for your proficiency, and the best way that they could rate proficiency was total time. And so people that were in coastal had far more time than those that were on fighters. And we ended up with a perhaps undue balance on coastal heavy bomber people vis-a-vis fighter people.
Mm-hmm.
In light of what happened mid-50s when we went totally into light fighters, all-weather fighters for the air defense.
That's but at the time, I suppose, because...
At the time, we had for the best balance they could think of for looking in their crystal balls. All you can say is the crystal ball was perhaps a little cloudy because come 57, 1957, here we've got 18 all-weather CF-100 squadrons and 12 Sabre squadrons, and we got to find people to man them.
Mm-hmm.
So in manning these, they just resorted to youngest, cream them up, doesn't matter what you want, through the jet stream and go flying all-weather fighters. Well, it's true. This is the only way it could be handled. Weather, and this is why perhaps mine is a back-assward career, in that normally one would progress along sort of twin engines, and then as you got a little long in the tooth, into four engines, etc., further along. Well, here I had this all in the younger days, and then as a fellow along in the tooth, I was expected to turn myself into a fighter pilot. Mind you, we wrote off a goodly number of boys trying this too.
Really?
A lot of the sort of potential wing or squadron commanders, wing commanders, we wrote off a good half dozen there. The year I went through jet training, 57. They were all keen, but pretty demanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose if you're not used to that kind of aircraft and its capabilities and handling...
Not so much this as go try to stay with the young fellows.
Oh, I get you.
We had one written off at the air show on the Toronto waterfront. I guess comes back to the old adage, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, there are no old bold pilots. But we had a number of unexplained ones. You may have recalled fairly recently beach jet disappearing off the radar streams heading towards Iceland. Mm-hmm. One of our boys did that in 58. He just 45,000 feet, headed out in the Atlantic and just kept right on going, unexplained. Of course, what has happened is he's got asphyxiation and doesn't realize that he's either already suffocated or very close to it, enough to be confused, and the airplane is flying itself on George. Just carries right on, they keep right on going until it runs out of fuel. This is what happens.
Well, let's get back to 1946 if we can. What was your first posting after you had been given your commission in the regular Air Force?
I went with the photo establishment in Rockcliffe. This was flying a Norseman, but I didn't stay there very long. Actually, we didn't do any flying at all. We were putting together the mosaics of pictures taken the previous summer, line overlays, and you put these all together, and of course they made maps from these. The whole of Canada had not been mapped yet, you see, and so they were setting up to complete the whole of the North Country with photographic overlays, and they would be done during the summertime and during the winter, or the fall and the winter, after the ships returned, the aircraft returned from the north to Rockcliffe. They'd spend all winter assembling these pictures so that the mapping people could use stereographic equipment and make their maps. Mm-hmm. And I was only there during the phase that they were doing overlays. I never did get to fly in the north with them. And then they posted me to 164 down in Dartmouth first, and then it moved to Moncton.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Dartmouth the 15th of May, 46. So you see my time after I left the squadron, February, the time the photo establishment was only a month and a half, 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Or so. And
Well, what was 164 Squadron? What were you flying?
It was Dakotas on the Milk Run supplying Goose Bay. And there would be a trip every day carrying both supplies and personnel into Goose Bay. Mind you, the major resupply was done by ship in the summer. Mm-hmm. To them come in the inlet at Goose Bay and supply them the hole for the following season and all their bulk fuel and things like this.
But you're doing mail and priority?
We bring in mail, personnel, fresh vegetables and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, there was a trip every day. And this was primarily sort of in anticipation formation of 426 Squadron. 426 was formed August 46 with the C-47s at Dartmouth. And then January, February 47, we had an American crew with C-54 Skymaster
mm-hmm.
into Dartmouth to check us out.
On the new Skymaster?
On the Skymaster. It wasn't new, it was their old Skymaster. But the North Stars were already in production in Canadair.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was take the Skymaster 1700 horsepower engine out and put in, 1200 horsepower engine out and put in 1700 horsepower Merlins.
Mm-hmm.
And with three, we had more power than they had on four, you see. This is why the North Star turned out such a
successful
airplane, partly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And plus the fact that it was a good cold weather airplane for the North.
Mm-hmm.
But
when did you finally get North Stars for Squadron
426? We got North Stars September 47 was our first North Star flight.
Mm-hmm.
We actually went to Canadair to pick them up. Al Lilly checked us out over there. He was their test pilot at Canadair.
Mm-hmm.
But there was five of us, I think, got checked out in Dartmouth. We were the basic sort of nucleus of 426 when it started. And we accepted all the airplanes from the Canadair, brought them over to our place where CP would sort of go through and accept on part of the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
on behalf of the Air Force, that is equipment lists and everything. And then we turned into the nucleus of 426 Squadron.
What was your main role at 426? You were out of Moncton, you said? Or was it Dartmouth?
Well, we were out of Dartmouth, and moved from Moncton down to Dartmouth, got checked out on the Skymaster,
mm-hmm.
and then moved to Montreal that summer. As I recall it, we were in Montreal a month or so before we got any aircraft, and we carried on with our 47s supplying Goose from Montreal.
Were the 47s being waived out of service, or were they just moving to another squadron or being sold to surplus?
No, we still had 437 Squadron at Edmonton flying Dakotas.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't phased out of service. They were flown quite a bit, different units. We just re-equipped with North Stars and reassigned the C-47s. They were getting pretty old, but not anything like they were to get. So 20 years later, they're still going.
Well, tell me, were the North Stars, were they a war development? Or it seems odd to me that right after the war, the Canadian Air Force would be getting new transport planes a year, perhaps a year and a half after hostilities were over. Rather expensive for a country gearing down for war.
It's the same problem that you're going through right now. It's trying to keep Canada Air busy. Here, now, you've got Canada Air that is sort of teed up building wartime planes like that. And then
all of a sudden
they had a partial order or a partial economic order in supplying TCA. TCA had the North Stars for quite a period of time.
They weren't a pressurized plane, were they?
Hmm?
They weren't a pressurized plane, were they?
Ours weren't. Theirs were, I think. Yes, I think theirs were. And but as I say, ours weren't. It was just enlarging the production line to make it economically viable. And now what do we do with them? Now we got them. Well, let's get 18 for the Air Force. This is the size of it.
And, well, how long were you with 426?
Till July 51.
Really, it's been a long time with that one squadron.
Fairly long.
Yeah.
Fairly long. Well, you got the nucleus of the old boys that were really sort of setting up what in effect was Transport Command, what was to turn into Transport Command at Trenton, with their leaps into the next generation airplane, you see. And we started there after receiving our airplanes, developing a sort of true rapid deployment force that stood us in good stead later. Having been on the Atlantic, this was the first sort of group of exercises. Actually, as a basic bread and butter, the North Stars took over from the Dakota in supplying Goose Bay. That was the basic bread and butter, and there was one trip a day into Goose Bay. Then we also set up a Western link to supply Whitehorse in the Yukon. And this was a full trans-Canadian service into Winnipeg, into Edmonton, into Whitehorse. And returning, and then we did that a couple of times a week for 2 years or so. But interspersed with this, we carried on this sort of rapid deployment exercise. We phased everybody through an initial training period in the North Atlantic during the trip. Then we did what we called the South Atlantic. Everybody went through a trip jumping from Montreal to Puerto Rico, to Georgetown, British Guiana, to Brazil, and across to Dakar, back up to Gibraltar, and then standard Transac home, whether it came northern route or southern route, was depending on the weather. And everybody faced through that one. And it's outlined in the book. Shows the squadron commander, Group Captain Massels, or Wing Commander Massels at that time, as the commander of the trip, in actual fact, it was taking a leaf out of the books of the KLM squadron, where they had a ship captain as what they called the sort of commodore.
Yes.
And seeing as how we had the squadron commander aboard, he became the commodore. but in actual fact, I was captain of the trip on the first South Atlantic. And we took an engine with us, spotlighted it down in Recife, Brazil, just in case. That was quite a trip, I tell you. We hit Georgetown, British Guiana, just as they were closing the base. See, the Americans used the southern route as their supply route to Africa, the North Africa campaign. And they had built a stepping stone of airfields exactly the same way as we had up around northern Canada to jump the short-range fighter stuff to Europe. Sort of Seven Islands, Goose Bay, Chimo, Frobisher, BW-1 to Iceland, Prestwick. This was, all these airfields were built to get the short-range fighters over to see, fly them over.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing was all the airfields done up your Alaskan Highway were all done for the same reason. They're all spaced nice. 400 to 500 miles apart is as far as the fighters can go, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same thing all down around the south at, and they'd jump off from Recife and go to Ascension Islands
mm-hmm.
in the center. That's how that airfield got there, and then jump to Dakar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we hit Georgetown, British Guiana, as I say, just as they were closing this base. And it was quite a base. They had a marvelous, what do they call these gardens that grow just with water, chemical water, a hydroponic garden.
Mm-hmm.
Grew all their vegetables for the base, but that's diverging a little bit too. In closing the base, they were closing the bar, so we could have sort of anything we wanted, and we filled up the airplane with sort of wholesale price, no export tax or anything. And this stood us in good stead further along, you see. As we went down into Brazil, we were taken care of by the Brazilian Air Force boys, and we could throw our party in return for their favors. And then we'd get across to Dakar, taken care of by the French boys there. Then we'd get up to Gibraltar, taken care of by the RAF there. All the way along, we'd have our party after they had their party. Hold up our end. But it was all made possible by getting all the sort of closing of the bar in Georgetown, British Guiana. Closing of the bar in Georgetown, British Guiana.
Well, tell me, how did the joining of NATO and the Korean War affect your squadron, or did it affect your squadron?
Well, yes, all these trips were marvelous sort of initial training break-in period for the assignment of 426 to the Korean airlift.
Well, you were assigned that, were you?
Oh, yes. The whole squadron went on that, and they made a pretty marvelous record. I only did a couple of trips myself, but I was in Montreal most of the time because what we had planned, or we actually executed, was elevate the Kojos of the existing crews to captains,
mm-hmm.
and then bring in the chaps from 427 Squadron and anyone else that was suitable, and we in Montreal would check them out as qualified co-pilots and send them off to McCord
mm-hmm.
to be matched up with one of the broken crews out there. So we really doubled our strength in very short order
mm-hmm.
in order to carry out the airlift.
Well, where would you be lifting from? Would it be from San Francisco or Vancouver? at to Japan.
Well, McCord to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking Fairfield. That's not it. What's the name of the capital? Not the capital. The major airport in Alaska.
Fairbanks.
Fairbanks. And then to the last airfield out on the Aleutian chain,
mm-hmm.
and from there to Tokyo. Coming back, we go to Wake, and then to Honolulu to Travis Stamford Air Force Base. Going over, we normally have a load of supplies or personnel out of McCord, and coming back a load of stretcher patients out of Japan from the Korean War,
mm-hmm.
lifting them, some of them, in fact all of them I think, were hospitalized Honolulu, but we were changing the load there from the stretcher cases out of Japan to the less urgent cases, transporting them from
Honolulu
to Traverse Air Force Base on the States.
Mm-hmm. And you say you made six round trips?
No, I only did a couple myself. As I say, I was based in Montreal,
okay.
elevating these Kojos, training the Kojos. They kept back a nucleus to do that. But we were picking up the detachments, we had detachments at each of these airfields to service the airplane,
mm-hmm.
picking up the detachments to bring them all home for Christmas, you see. We moved the squadron home for Christmas and then sent out airplanes from Montreal to pick up all the detachment boys around and bring them home.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was marvelous sort of training that we went through previously that allowed them to get into doing a 426 operation like the Korean Airlift. With an unblemished record, really. We operated differently than the Americans. The Americans, their ops officer had total control. He could sort of, he laid on their trips and told their pilots exactly what altitude to fly and when they could depart, when they should get there, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas our skippers, when they departed, they had total control and made the trip whatever way they liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they were most astounded. I did one trip from Shemya, that's the airfield, the end of the Aleutian chain, to Tokyo. Because of headwinds, I was down 2,000 feet. And they were telling me, well, you can't do that. But I'm going to do that. All we did was climb up at the very, just before reaching Tokyo in order to come on radar screen at a relatively high altitude rather than coming in at 2,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the type of latitude we had compared to their crews. They would just sit on the ground. They couldn't do it. They wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, how long was the airlift on for during the entire war? The Korean airlift as such?
I'd have to look it up. It was on for 18 months or so.
And for most of the time you were in Montreal training these Kojos?
In Montreal, yeah.
Yeah. But still attached to 426 squadron? Like you're still part of the squadron?
Well, we were called Station Lachine then.
Mm-hmm.
But we were more or less under control as 426 squadron people, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the war, when the squadron got back to normal, did you return to 426?
No, I was posted then I had been transferred out before the lift started as adjutant to Goose Bay,
mm-hmm.
and I was only there for a month and a half or so, 2 months, when I was recalled to Lishan,
mm-hmm.
to because the Korean airlift had been laid on, you see, then. Well, as soon as the squadron returned to Montreal, I returned to desk job again, posting as the adjutant. Goose Bay was my desk tour, and mm-hmm. I just returned to a desk tour in the personnel branch headquarters. That was my next one.
Mm-hmm. And you were there until you were assigned to Jets?
Well, no. I was there for a normal 3-year tour, and then in the personnel branch, and then went to staff college for 1 year.
Did you? Where? And in Canada or the U.S.?
No, in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there went on the 1-year jet training conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And from there went to Comox for my jet tour.
And you were flying the 100s, weren't you?
CF-100s, yes.
Yeah. Well, how did you find the changeover from flying big 2 and 4 engine planes to flying a single or a twin engine jet?
Oh, it's... I remember they took us up in T-33s first, and I thought this fighter game's for the birds the first couple of trips. But after a while, you get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, by then, it was becoming common knowledge in the service that they were creaming off all the younger age, and everybody was going down the jet mill, and there was only 2 choices, really. Do you want to go Sabres, or do you want to go CF-100s? Well, Sabres were single engine and true day fighters, vis-a-vis twin engine short haul weather, so there wasn't too much of a difference there in choice for me. Right away, go 2 engine.
But weren't Sabres assigned immediately to NATO in Europe, and the 100s were sort of Canadian, or were there a mixture of the two in both places?
The Sabres were, for a short while, were over here, and then we had the Leapfrog operations flying them over.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't assigned to NATO immediately, although perhaps that was the intention, but the build-up was at home here, and we had Sabres took over from the Vampires.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a couple of squadrons at St. Hubert, we had a couple of squadrons down Chatham, New Brunswick, some up North Bay, I believe. But these all flew overseas in the Leapfrog operations, and they're sort of places at the various airfields were taken by CF-100 squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
We had them based Chatham, and then St. Hubert's, Bagotville, North Bay, and then Comox. Then, as the build-up continued, we had 4 squadrons, CF-100s, overseas, too.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this was straining resources insofar as the commanding level went, because it's an awful lot of squadrons to man with COs and flight commanders, etc., from the old line boys, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said you were assigned to Comox.
Mm-hmm.
Had they been flying jet fighters out of Comox before, or was that had it been a piston engine?
No. This was all set up as part of a major system. It all came in at the same time as the Mid-Canada line and the
Blue line and whatnot.
Well, the Dew Line was a major one across the top.
There
was no airfields. They weren't a control radar. They were strictly a penetration radar fence, more or less. And the two lines operated different principles. The Dew line was a true radar line.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be very close to today's radar in picking up airplanes. They could have controlled if they had any airfields up there, any airplanes to control,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have any fighters that far north. Then across the center we had the Mid-Canada line, which was a Doppler line. It was just a signal going between two stationary posts, and if you cut it, you knew something had cut it, that was all.
How big a thing would you need to register on that? Like, would it
be very small. We were having one hell of a problem with Canada Goose showing up. Oh yeah, it picks up everything. What it does is disturbs the Doppler signal, you see, and immediately registers that the command station has a zigzag on the pole,
mm-hmm.
on the tape, and everything was disturbing it. As I say, the Canada geese would make a nice signature on it. Airplanes too. Well, then south of that again, the Doppler line, Mid-Canada line, is sort of Churchill to Flin Flon across our station, Cranbury Portage there, halfway between Flin Flon and
La
Paz.
This was after your tour?
This was after my tour,
yeah. It was 1958,
1960. And the line ran right across sort of the middle of Hudson Bay, James Bay, where the isthmus is in the center there. Winnisca is down about even with the top end of James Bay.
Mm-hmm.
But then south of that again, you had what you call the Pine Tree Line. And this was a true radar line with the controlling fighters. And this was where you're depending on a break in the Dew line, somebody penetrating, and then they would break the Mid-Canada line in the center, and this would get your first alert to your fighters, and they would scramble in the first penetration on the Pine Tree line.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be vectored on to targets by the Pine Tree radars. Well, this whole thing was extremely sort of expensive, and it was a joint, and this really is the basics of NORAD when it first started, because we couldn't do it all by ourselves, and it wasn't necessary for the defense of Canadian. It was primarily lumping North America as an entity and saying, right, we'll try and protect as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why you have the sort of distribution we had with Chatham, Bagtown, St. Hubert's, North Bay. They're protecting the whole northeast, your great big complexes, Montreal included,
mm-hmm.
but Boston, New York, Washington, whole northeast mm-hmm. complex. Well then, ours out west, Comox and Coal Lake to a certain extent, we had our full radar set up, controlling radar. Holbert was part of the Pine Tree Line, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They were our controlling radar and were protecting.